Thank you so much. There are at least three guys named Valentine, not including Bobby, who are said to maybe be tied to St. Valentine's Day. The St. Valentine's Day stories are in fact more legendary than historical. The Roman Emperor Claudius II, for instance, believed that single men made the best soldiers. So he forbid his legionaries to be married. And one of the Valentines performed weddings for the Roman soldiers in secret. This was the first example of don't ask, don't tell in the military. For his trouble, Valentine was thrown into prison. He fell in love with the blind daughter of his jailer. You really don't get more romantic than that. It is said that, however, he performed a miracle by healing her blindness. And he sent her love letters signed, naturally, from your Valentine. Though the current practice goes back really only to the Victorian age in England, due to the confluence of cheap postage rates and mass-produced cards. Now, why is St. Valentine's Day on February 14th? Whenever there's a feast day of a legendary saint, you can usually depend on the fact that it's covering up a much older pagan holiday. In this case, Lupercalia, which involved young men showing their affection for special young women in ways that are rather more explicit, shall we say, than sending them a card. And over Lupercalia, as over many of the older pagan feast days, the Christian religion placed a feast day of a saint. In fact, it's one of the lasting strengths of Christianity to constantly be able to assume and consume the practices of many cultures and call them its own. In fact, this tendency started right from the beginning. The symbol of a god that dies and comes back to life is found in many mythologies. And the saint, like Valentine, who fights and sometimes yields to the pleasures of the flesh, is likewise a common theme. Another legendary saint like Valentine is Saint Bridget, who is almost entirely legendary. She was big on the lighting of candles in worship, which Christianity eventually saw as a good idea itself. Bridget, as some of you know, started out as an Irish goddess and then became a Roman saint. There is some argument as to whether this was a promotion or not. But even amongst the historical saints, the sinning young man who becomes a vessel of God is a common and recurring theme. The Confessions of St. Augustine are exactly that. He very explicitly explains that as a young man, he yielded to all sorts of temptation. The years that St. Francis spent as a student and aspiring musician would be familiar to any number of students and aspiring musicians today, who indulge themselves sometimes foolishly before settling down to a more solid ground. This journey from the profane to the sacred, and sometimes back and forth several times, is a continuing theme in Christianity because of its continued attachment to the duality of the world, dividing the world between the saved and the damned, the sinners and saints, between heaven and hell, and yes, even right and wrong and good and evil. For it's based on the idea that at all times, one must clearly know which is which and act accordingly, which is difficult for anyone who's tried it. But many of us keep on trying. And by here, I'm not speaking in terms of finding right action in a Buddhist sense or or mindfulness, but looking upon what is good and evil as always and eternally fixed and knowable. Now, there is one such person who struggled in this way and resolved the struggle by bringing some of that pagan style into the church, as surely as St. Bridget did with bringing her candles in, or St. Francis with his prayers to the annals. Thomas Dorsey was born in 1899, and in the mid-1920s was a major league sideman for some of the big names in blues. He played with Ma Rainey's Wildcat Jazz Band and with Tampa Red. He was known by many names: Georgia Tom, Barrel House Tom, and Texas Tommy. Like Augustine and Francis, Georgia Tom found that the social ramble was not restful. He had a nervous breakdown and another. And so he turned to the church, and he began playing piano not on Saturday night, but on Sunday morning. Now, the problem with Thomas Dorsey doing this was that he played the same style piano on Sunday morning that he had played on Saturday night. His gospel songs had a syncopation. It was full of those evil seventh chords. It was not so much, but it was. This was an outrage. And this was in the black church. You know, we're used to thinking that the black churches just naturally and always sounded like Aretha Franklin and Otis Redding. But before Thomas Dorsey, they didn't. While they might not have been as unfunky as most Unitarian churches, they were certainly not like the triple rock church as portrayed in the Blues Brothers. Dorsey had invented something that he called the gospel blues, and it was not accepted in the black church at first. And then, in 1932, Thomas Dorsey's wife and child died in childbirth. And he wrote a song while in that state of inconsolable grief. Precious Lord was such a powerful hymn and such a pure expression of feeling that it transcended the category of blues or gospel. And it became the first of the gospel blues songs to be widely sung in black churches. Later that same year, Dorsey became musical director of Pilgrim Baptist Church on the south side of Chicago, where he stayed until 1972. In 1937, he wrote a song especially for a young singer that he had been mentoring. And Peace in the Valley became the perfect vehicle for Mahalia Jackson's voice. And it was such a universal and transcendent expression that it became a hit song not only for her, but for country and western artist Red Foley, and later Elvis. She sang it at Martin Luther King's funeral. And for 40 years, every great gospel singer and ensemble came to the Pilgrim Baptist Church, from Aretha Franklin to James Cleveland to the Staple Singers and the Edwin Hawkins Singers. And Thomas Dorsey became the first African American to be inducted into the National Songwriters Hall of Fame. And Bill, you might be interested to know that he started the first black song publishing company because he didn't like the way that the black artists were being treated by the white publishing companies. And that's how Georgia Tom became known as the father of gospel music. So the point is, the gospel music as we know it today didn't just happen by accident or historical necessity. It was once called the gospel blues and was created through the genius and the grief of Georgia Tom and Ma Rainey and Tampa Red. Because music knows no boundaries. Music does not make a distinction between Saturday night and Sunday morning. Music does not know saints and sinners. Music does not know the saved from the damned. Music just knows, this is how I feel now. Anthony Charles William II is the son of a well-known Pentecostal minister in San Diego. His story appears in the February 8th issue of the New Yorker. He took over the ministry of his father's church a few years ago when his father died. Anthony is 34 years old, and he goes professionally by the name of Tone, spelled T-O-N-E-X, but he pronounces it Tone. And for the last few years has been considered the most innovative and talented gospel singer in the country. A gospel Michael Jackson, a gospel Prince. He could sing the old gospel songs with a high and beautiful tenor and a transcendent falsetto. But he sang gospel songs in every style, including hip-hop and techno, which challenged his adult audience, but was a revelation to the younger people in the church, who could now hear contemporary sounds without the violent and misogynistic lyrics of so much of secular music. He was the future of gospel music until recently, when he came out as gay. For gospel music in the black church has long been a refuge, if you will, a segregated part, where black and lesbian people were free to express themselves and bring their gifts to church in an acceptable way. It was a place for them to be part of the church, but really, it was another form of don't ask, don't tell. The great gospel singer James Cleveland settled a case out of court against an underage boy. Little Richard, the original falsetto singer, never has come out. So a gay gospel singer can succeed by singing about how sinful he is and how he needs the Lord's forgiveness without naming the sin. But no gospel singer has ever succeeded by saying, I'm gay and I don't believe it's a sin. Unitarian Universalists have no idea how deep and vile the homophobia is in areas of the black church. Go online and search Tonex, T-O-N-E-X, plus gay, and you'll find out. You will see Christians say everything about gay and lesbian people, and this young man whom they once idolized as the future of their musical form, and read everything said about him that can be said about the despised and wretched of the earth. So what a burden upon this young man. How brave an act like many such in which he perhaps felt he no longer had a choice. Maybe he will become a mainstream secular singer. Many before him have taken that route. But maybe, just maybe, he will be a little bit to his generation what Thomas Dorsey was to his. A person who spoke from such a deep and painful place, searching for solace that it transcended categories, from a place that knew no saints or sinners, a place that knew no saved and damned, a place that knows only, this is how I feel now. Can you play something like to the beat of the car alarm there? May we join together in number 210, our final.